burnt lawn, the monk was sitting on a blackened stone bench, his elbows on his knees, his chin on his palms. "This must seem strange to you, but everything here is so familiar. I could tell you how many blocks of stone make up this walkway or the scriptorium. I can tell you how many window panes were in the abbey, the exact day of the year and the time of day the sun peaks directly over the church. How Brother Jinlin used to eat with two forks because he vowed never to touch a knife. How Brother Heslon was always the first one up and always fell asleep during Vespers." Myron pointed across from them at the blackened stump of a tree. "Brother Renyon and I buried a squirrel there when we were 10 years old. A tree sprouted the following week. It grew white blossoms in spring, and not even the abbot could tell what species it was. Everyone in the abbey called it the squirrel tree. We all thought it was a miracle, and that perhaps the squirrel was a servant of Maribor, who was thanking us for taking such good care of his friend." Myron paused a moment and used the long sleeves of his robe to wipe his face as he stared at the stump. He pulled his gaze away and looked once more at Hadrian. "I could tell you how in winter the snow could get up to the second-story windows, and it was like we were all squirrels living in this cozy burrow, all safe and warm. I could tell you how each one of us was the very best at what we did. Jinlin made wine so light it evaporated on your tongue, leaving only the taste of wonder. Venetilian made the warmest, softest shoes. You could walk out in the snow and never know you left the abbey. To say Heslon could cook is an insult. He would make steaming plates of scrambled eggs mixed with cheeses, peppers, onions, and bacon, all in a light, spicy cream sauce. He'd follow this with rounds of sweetbread, each topped with a honey cinnamon drizzle, smoked pork rounds, salafon sausage, flaky powdered pastries, freshly churned sweet butter, and a ceramic pot of dark mint tea. And that was just for breakfast." Myron smiled, his eyes closed, with a dreamy look on his face. "What did Renyon do?" Hadrian asked. "The fellow you buried the squirrel with. What was his specialty?" Myron opened his eyes, but was slow to answer. He looked back at the stump of the tree across from them and said softly, "Renyon died when he was 12. He caught a fever. We buried him right there, next to the squirrel tree. It was his favorite place in the world." He paused, taking a breath that was not quite even. A frown pulled at his mouth, tightening his lips. "There hasn't been a day that has gone by since then that I haven't said good morning to him. I usually sit here and tell him how his tree is doing, how many new buds there were, or when the first leaf turned or fell. For the last few days, I've had to lie, because I couldn't bring myself to tell him it was gone." Tears fell from Myron's eyes, and his lips quivered as he looked at the stump. "All morning I've been trying to tell him goodbye. I've been trying." He faltered and paused to wipe his eyes. "I've been trying to explain why I have to leave him now. But you see, Renyon is only 12. And I don't think he really understands." Myron put his face in his hands and wept. Hadrian squeezed Myron's shoulder. "We'll wait for you at the gate. Take all the time you need." When Hadrian emerged from the entrance, Ulrich barked at him. "What in the world is taking so bloody long? If he's going to be this much trouble, we might as well leave him." "We aren't leaving him, and we'll wait as long as it takes," Hadrian told them. Ulrich and Royce exchanged glances, but neither said a word. Myron joined them only a few minutes later with a small bag containing his belongings. Although he was obviously upset, his mood lightened at the sight of the horses. "Oh, my!" he exclaimed. Hadrian took Myron by the hand, like a young child, and led him over to his speckled white mare. The horse, its massive body moving back and forth as the animal shifted its weight from one leg to another, looked down at Myron with large, dark eyes.
"Do they bite?"
"Not usually," Hadrian replied. "Here, you can pat him on the neck."
"It's so big," Myron said with a look of terror on his face.
He moved his hand to his mouth as if he might be sick.
"Please, just get on the horse, Myron."
Ulrich's tone showed his irritation.
"Don't mind him," Hadrian said. "You can ride behind me. I'll get on first and pull you up after, okay?"
Myron nodded, but the look on his face indicated he was anything but okay. Hadrian mounted and then extended his arm. With closed eyes, Myron reached out, and Hadrian pulled him up. The monk held on tightly and buried his face in the large man's back.
"Remember to breathe, Myron," Hadrian told him, as he turned the horse and began to walk back down the switchback trail.
The morning started cold, but eventually warmed some. Still, it wasn't as pleasant as it had been the day before. They entered the shelter of the valley and headed toward the lake. Everything was still wet from the rain, and the tall fields of autumn-browned grass soaked their feet and legs as they brushed past. The wind came from the north now, and blew into their faces. Overhead, a chevron of geese honked against the grey sky. Winter was on its way. Myron soon overcame his fear and picked his head up to look about.
"Dear Maribor, I had no idea grass grew this high, and the trees are so tall. You know, I had seen pictures of trees this size, but I always thought the artists were just bad at proportion."
The monk began to twist left and right to see all around him. Hadrian chuckled.
"Myron, you squirm like a puppy."
Lake Windermere appeared like grey metal pooling at the base of the barren hills. Although it was one of the largest lakes in Avon, the fingers of the surrounding cliffs hid much of it from view. Its vast, open face reflected the desolate sky and appeared cold and empty. Except for a few birds, little moved on the stony clefts. They reached the western bank. Thousands of fist-sized rocks, rubbed smooth and flat by the lake, made a loose cobblestone plain where they could walk and listen to the quiet lapping of the water. From time to time, rain would briefly fall. They would watch it come across the surface of the lake, the crisp horizon blurring as the raindrops broke the stillness, and then it would stop while the clouds above swirled undecidedly. Royce, as usual, led the small party. He approached the north side of the lake and found what appeared to be the faint remains of a very old and unused road leading toward the mountains beyond. Myron's wriggling was finally subsiding. He sat behind Hadrian, but didn't move for quite some time.
"Myron, you okay back there?" Hadrian asked.
"Hmm? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I was watching the way the horses walk. I've been observing them for the last few miles. They are fascinating animals. Their back feet appear to step in exactly the same place their front feet left an instant before. Although, I suppose they aren't feet at all, are they? Hooves! That's right. These are hooves. Enelina, in old speech."
"Old speech?"
"The ancient imperial language. Few people outside the clergy know it these days. It's something of a dead language. Even in the days of the Empire, it was only used in church services. But that's gone out of style, and no one writes in it anymore."
Hadrian felt Myron rest his head against his back, and for the rest of the ride, watched to make sure that Myron didn't doze off and fall. They turned away from the lakeside and started into a broad ravine that became rocky as they climbed. The more they progressed, the more apparent it was to Ulrich that they were travelling on what had once been a road. The path was too smooth to be wholly natural, and yet, over time, rocks had fallen from the heights, and cracks had formed where weeds forced themselves out of the crevices. Centuries had taken their toll, but there remained a faint trace of something ancient and forgotten. Despite the cold, the intermittent rain, and the strange circumstance of his being there, Ulrich wasn't nearly as miserable as he let on. There was an odd tranquillity to the trip that day. Not often had the prince travelled so simply in such inclement weather, and he found it captivating by its sheer strangeness. The vast silence, the muted light, the haunting clip-clop of the horse's hooves, everything suggested adventure in a fashion he had never experienced before. His most daring escapades had always been organized and catered by servants. He had never been on his own like this, never truly in danger. When he had found himself bound in the boat, he had been furious. No one had ever treated him with such disregard. Striking a member of the royal family was punishable by death, and because it was, most avoided even touching him. To be trussed up like an animal was humiliating beyond his comprehension. It had never occurred to him that he could come to harm. He had fully expected to be rescued at any moment. That prospect had dimmed dramatically as they had travelled into the deep forests on their way to Windermere. He had been serious when he had said it was the worst night of his life, but in the morning when the rain let up, and after the meal, he found what he could describe only as a second wind. The prospect of seeking out this mysterious prison and its reputed inmate smacked of real adventure. Perhaps, more than anything, it kept his mind occupied. He was busy trying to stay alive and determine the identity of a killer, which kept him from dwelling on the death of his father. On occasion, while riding, when no one spoke for a time and silence took hold, his mind would touch on his father's death. He would be back in the royal bedchamber, seeing his father's pale face and that tiny tear of dried blood near the corner of his lips. Ulrich expected to feel something. He expected to cry, but that never happened. He felt nothing, and wondered what that meant. Back at the castle, everyone would be wearing black and the halls would be filled with the sounds of weeping, just like when his mother had died. No music, no laughter, and it had seemed like more than a month without the sun shining. He was relieved, almost happy, when the period of mourning ended. Part of him felt guilty for that, and yet it was as if a terrible weight had been lifted. That was how it would be if he were at the castle. Solemn faces, weeping, and the priests passing a candle for him to walk around the casket with while they chanted. He had done that as a child, and hated it. Ulrich was glad he was not there, trapped and drowning in that well of sorrow that he could not tap. He would deal with it all the next day, but for today he was grateful to be on a distant road with no one of importance for company. Royce drew his horse to a stop. They were alone since the others had a tendency to lag behind as their horse carried two. "Why are we stopping?" Ulrich asked. "It's leveling off, so we're probably close. Have you forgotten that this might be a trap?" "No," the prince said. "I'm quite aware of that fact."
"Good.
Then in that case, farewell, Your Majesty," Royce told him. Ulrich was stunned.
"You're not coming?"
"Your sister only asked us to bring you here. If you want to get yourself killed, that's your affair. Our obligation is complete." Instantly, Ulrich felt foolish for his earlier misguided satisfaction in being alone with strangers. He couldn't afford to lose his only guides, or he would never find his way back. After only a moment's thought, he said,
Then I suppose this is a perfect time to tell you I'm officially bestowing the title of Royal Protectors on you and Hadrian, now that I'm certain you aren't trying to kill me. You'll be responsible for defending the life of your king.
Really?
How thoughtful of you, Your Highness. Royce grinned. I suppose this is a good time to tell you I don't serve kings. Unless they pay me.
No?
Ulrich smiled wryly. All right, then. Consider it this way. If I live to return to Essendon Castle, I'll happily rescind your execution orders and forgive your unlawful entry of my castle. However, if I die out here or am taken captive and locked away in this prison, you'll never be able to return to Medford. My uncle has already labelled you murderers of the highest order. I'm sure there are already men searching. Uncle Percy might seem like a courtly old gentleman, but believe me, I've seen his ugly side, and he can be quite scary. He's the best swordsman in Melengar, did you know that? So, if sovereign loyalty isn't good enough for you, you might consider the practical benefits of keeping me alive. The ability to convince others that your life is worth more than theirs must be a prerequisite for being king. Not a prerequisite, but it certainly helps, Ulrich replied, with a grin.
It will still cost you, Royce said, and the prince's grin faded. Let's say 100 gold tenants.
100?
Ulrich protested.
Do you think your life is worth less?
Besides, it's what DeWitt promised, so that seems fair. But there's one other thing. If we're going to be your protectors, you'll have to do as I say. I can't safeguard you if you don't. And since we aren't just risking your silly little life, but my future as well, I'll have to insist.
Ulrich huffed. He didn't like the way they treated him. They should feel honored to do his bidding. Besides, he was granting them absolution of serious crimes. And instead of showing gratitude, the man demanded payment. This type of behavior was just what he expected from thieves. Still, he needed them.
Like all good rulers, it's understood there are times when we must listen to skilled advisers. Just remember who I am, and who I'll be when I get back to Medford.
As Hadrian and Myron caught up, Royce said,
Hadrian, we've just been promoted to Royal Protectors.
Does it pay more?
Actually, it does. It also weighs less. Give the prince back his sword. Hadrian handed the huge sword of Amrath to Ulrich, who slipped the broad leather baldric over one shoulder and strapped on the weapon. The sword was too big for him, and he felt a bit foolish, but at least he thought it looked better now that he was dressed and mounted.
The captain of the guard took this off my father and handed it to me.
Was it only two nights past?
It was Tolan Essendon's sword, handed down from king to prince for 700 years. We are one of the oldest unbroken families in Averon.
Royce dismounted and handed the reins of his horse to Hadrian.
I'm going to scout up ahead and make sure there are no surprises waiting.
He left with surprising swiftness in a hunched run. He entered the shadows of the ravine and vanished.
How does he do that?
Ulrich asked.
Creepy, isn't it?
Hadrian said.
How did he do what?
Myron stared at a cattail he had plucked just before they left the lakeside.
These things are marvellous, by the way.
They waited for several minutes, and at the sound of a bird song, Hadrian ordered them forward. The road curved left and then right, until they could once again see the lake, which was now far below and looked like a large, bright puddle. The road began to narrow and at last stopped. To either side, hills rose at a gradual slope, but directly in front of them, the path ended at a straight, sheer cliff extending upward several hundred feet.
"Are we in the wrong place?"
Hadrian asked.
"It's supposed to be a hidden prison," Ulrich reminded them.
I just assumed, Hadrian said, being up here in the middle of nowhere was what was meant by hidden. I mean, if you didn't know the prison was here, would you come to such a place?
If this was made by the best minds of what was left of the Empire, Ulrich said, it's likely to be hard to find, and harder to enter.
Legends hold it was mostly constructed by dwarves,
Myron explained.
Lovely, Royce said. It's going to be another Drummondor.
We had issues getting into a dwarf-constructed fortress in Turdal Fir a few years back, Hadrian explained. It wasn't pretty. We might as well get comfortable. This could take a while.
Royce searched the cliff. The stone directly before the path was exposed, as if recently sheared off, and while moss and small plants grew among the many cracks elsewhere, none were found anywhere near the cliff face.
There's a door here. I know it, the thief said,
running his hands lightly across the stone.
Damn dwarves. I can't find a hinge, crack, or seam.
Myron, Ulrich asked, did you read anything about how to open the door to the prison? I've heard tales about dwarves having a fondness for riddles, and sometimes they make keys out of sounds, words that, when spoken, unlock doors.
Myron shook his head as he climbed down off the horse.
Words that unlock doors.
Royce looked at the prince skeptically.
Are these fairy tales you're listening to?
An invisible door sounds like a fairy tale to me, Ulrich replied, so it seems appropriate.
It's not invisible. You can see the cliff, can't you? It's merely well hidden. Dwarves can cut stone with such precision you can't see a gap.
You do have to admit, Royce, Hadrian said, what dwarves can do with stone is amazing.
Royce glared over his shoulder at him.
Don't talk to me.
Hadrian smiled.
Royce doesn't much care for the wee folk. Open in the name of Navron!
Ulrich suddenly shouted with a commanding tone, his voice echoing between the stony slopes.
Royce spun around and fixed the prince with a withering stare.
Don't do that again.
Well, you weren't making any progress. I just thought perhaps, since this was or is a church prison, maybe a religious command would unlock it. Myron, is there some standard religious saying to open a door? You should know about this. Is there such a thing?
I'm not a priest of Nephron. The Winds Abbey was a monastery of Maribor.
Oh, that's right,
Ulrich said, looking disappointed.
I mean, I know about the Church of Nephron, Myron clarified. But since I'm not a member, I'm not privy to any secret codes or chants or such.
Really? Hadrian said. I thought you monks were just sort of like the poorer, younger brother of the Nephron Church.
Myron smiled.
If anything, we'd be the older but still poorer brother. Worshipping Emperor Navron is a relatively recent event that began a few decades after the Emperor's death.
So you monks worship Maribor while the Nephrons worship Navron?
Close, the monk said. The Nephron Church also worships Maribor, but they just put more emphasis on Navron. The main difference comes down to what you are looking for. We monks believe in a personal devotion to Maribor, seeking his will in quiet places. It's through ancient rituals and in this silence that he speaks to us in our hearts. We're striving to know Maribor better. The Church of Nephron, on the other hand, focuses on trying to understand Maribor's will. They believe the birth of Navron demonstrates Maribor's desire to take a direct hand in controlling the fate of mankind. As such, they are very involved in politics. You're familiar with the story of Navron, aren't you?
Hadrian pursed his lips. He was the first emperor, and defeated the elves in some war a long time ago. I'm not sure why that makes him a god.
He's not, actually.
Then Why do so many people worship him?
Novron is believed to be the son of Maribor, sent to aid us in our darkest hour. There are 6 actual gods. Erebus is the father of all the gods, and he made the world of Elan. He brought forth 3 sons and a daughter. The eldest son, Feral, is a master of magic and created the elves. His second son is Drom, the master craftsman who created the dwarves. The youngest is Maribor, and he, of course, created man. It was Erebus' daughter, Muriel, who created the animals, birds, and the fish in the sea.
That's 5.
Yes, there's also Ubalin, the son of Erebus and Muriel.
The god of darkness, Ulrich put in. Yeah, I've heard of him, but wait, are you saying the father had a child with his own daughter?
It was a terrible mistake, Myron explained. Erebus forced himself on Muriel while in a drunken rage. Their union resulted in the birth of Ubalin.
That must have been awkward at family gatherings, raping your own daughter and all, Hadrian said.
Quite. In fact, Erebus's original sons, Feral, Drome, and Maribor, slew him because of the incident. When Ubalin tried to defend his father, all 3 turned on him and imprisoned their nephew, or would that be brother? I guess it's really both, isn't it? Well, anyway, they locked Ubalin in the depths of Elan. Even though he was born through a terrible violation, Muriel was heartbroken to lose her only son and refused to speak to her brothers again.
So, now we're back to 5 gods.
Not exactly. Many people believe that a god is immortal and cannot die. There are some cults that believe Erebus still lives and wanders Elan as a man searching for forgiveness for his crime.
The day was growing dark, and the wind picked up, heralding another possible storm. The horses started to become spooked, so Hadrian went to check on them. Ulrich got up and walked around, rubbing his legs and muttering about being saddle-sore.
Myron, Hadrian called over, would you like to help me unsaddle them? I don't think we'll be leaving soon.
Of course, the monk said eagerly. Now, how do I do that?
Together, Hadrian and Myron relieved the animals of their saddles and packs and stowed the gear under a small rock ledge. Myron summoned the courage every so often to stroke their necks. Once everything was put away, Hadrian suggested Myron gather some grass for the animals while he went to check on Royce. His partner sat on the path, staring at the cliff. Occasionally, the thief would get up, examine a portion of the wall, and sit back down grumbling.
Well, how's it going?
I hate dwarves, Royce replied.
Most people do.
Yes, but I have a reason.
The bastards are the only ones that can make boxes I can't open. You'll open it. It won't be pretty and it won't be soon, but you'll open it. What I don't understand is why would Arista send us here knowing that we couldn't get in?
Royce sat on his haunches, his cloak draped out around him. His eyes remained focused, but he was frustrated.
I can't even see anything. If I could even find just a crack, then maybe...
But how can I break a lock when I can't even find the door? Hadrian gave him a reassuring pat on the shoulder before returning to Myron, who had finished feeding the horses and had joined Ulrich, sitting over by the cliff's wall.
How's it coming? Ulrich asked, with a bit of annoyance in his voice. Nothing yet, just leave him be. Royce will figure it out. It just takes some time.
Hadrian turned his attention back to Myron.
I was thinking about what you were saying before. If Ubalin is considered a god, why did you say Novron isn't? After all, they're both children of gods, right?
Well, no. Technically, he's a demigod, part god, part human. You see, Maribor sent Novron to... Well,
Let me jump back a bit. Okay, so Ferrol was the oldest, and when he created the elves, they spread, albeit slowly, across all of Ilan. When Drome came along, he granted his children control of the underground world. This left no place for Maribor's children, so mankind was forced to struggle in the most wretched corners left to us. So the elves got all the good places, and we got stuck with the dregs. That doesn't sound very fair, Hadrian said. Well, our ancestors weren't happy about that either. Not to mention humans reproduce much more quickly than elves, who have a much longer lifespan. This made conditions rather crowded, and it only got worse when the dwarves were driven to the surface.
Driven? By whom?
You remember what I said about the gods locking Ubalin in the underworld? Well, he created his own race, just like Drome, Maribor, and Ferrol.
Ah, the goblins.
I can see how they would make things less homey down there.
Exactly. Between mankind's growing numbers and the emergence of the dwarves, our ancestors were being crushed. So they begged Maribor for help. He heard their pleas, and tricked his brother Drome into forging the great sword Relicon. Then he convinced his other brother Ferrol to enchant the weapon. All he needed was a warrior to wield it, so he came to Ilan in disguise and slept with a mortal woman. Their union produced Novron the Great. He united all the tribes of mankind and led them in a war against the elves. Armed with the Relicon, Novron was victorious, and so began mankind's dominance, led by Novron, who had united all of humanity.
Okay, that makes sense. But when did we start worshipping Novron as a god?
That occurred after his death. The Church of Nephron was established to pay homage to Novron as the savior of mankind. The newly formed church became the official religion of the Empire, but farther away from the imperial capital of Persipliquus, people remembered the old ways and continued to worship Maribor as they always had.
And that would be you. The monks of Maribor, I mean.
Myron nodded. During their discussion, storm clouds continued to form, filling the sky and darkening the ravine. What light remained was an odd hue, adding a sense of the surreal to the landscape. Soon the wind began gusting through the pass, blowing dirt into the air. In the distance echoed the low rumble of thunder.
"Any luck with the door, Royce?"
Hadrian called over. He sat resting with his back against the cliff, his legs outstretched, and he tapped the tips of his boots together.
"Because it looks like we're in for another cold, wet night. Only this time we won't have any shelter."
Royce muttered something indiscernible. Down below, framed by the walls of the ravine, the surface of the lake shone like a mirror facing the sky. Every now and then it would flash brilliantly as lightning flickered in the distance. Royce grumbled again.
"What's that?" Hadrian asked.
"I was just thinking about what you said earlier. Why would Arista send us here if she knew we couldn't get in? She must have thought we could. Maybe to her it was obvious."
"Maybe it's magic,"
Ulrich said, pulling his cloak tighter.
"Enough with the enchanted words," Royce told him. "Locks are mechanical. Believe me, I know a thing or two on the subject. Dwarves are very clever and very skilled, but they don't make doors that unlock because of a sound.
I just brought it up because Arista could do some. So maybe getting in was easy for her."
"Do some what?" Hadrian asked.
"Magic."
"Your sister is a witch?"
Myron asked, disturbed. Ulrich laughed.
"You could certainly say that, yes. But it has little to do with her magical prowess.
She went to Sheridan University for a few years and learned magical theory. It never amounted to much, but she was able to do a few things. For instance, she magically locks the door to her room, and I think she made the Countess Amaryl sick over some dispute about a boy. Poor Amaryl was covered in boils for a week.
Royce looked over at Ulrich. What do you mean, magically locks her door?
There's never been a lock on it, but no one can open it but her.
Did you ever see your sister unlock her door?
Ulrich shook his head. I wish I had.
Myron, Royce said, did you ever read anything about unusual locks or keys? Maybe something associated with dwarves?
There's the tale of Iberius and the Giant, where Iberius uses a key forged by dwarves to open the giant's treasure box, but it wasn't magical, just big. There's also the Collar of Liam from the Myth of the Forgotten, which refused to unlock until the wearer was dead. I guess that doesn't help much, does it? Let me think. Perhaps it has something to do with gemlocks.
Gemlocks?
They're not magical either, but they were invented by dwarves. They're gems that interact with other stones to create subtle vibrations. Gemlocks are generally used when several people need to open the same locked container. All they need is a matching gem. For particularly valuable containers, the lock might require a specific cut which modifies the resonance. Truly gifted gemsmiths could make a lock that actually changed with the seasons, allowing different gems to unlock it at different times of the year. This is what gave rise to the idea of birthstones, because certain stones have more strength at certain times.
That's it, Royce interrupted. What's it? Ulrich asked.
Royce reached into his breast pocket and pulled out a dark blue ring. Ulrich jumped to his feet.
That's my father's ring. Give it to me.
Fine, Royce said, tossing it toward the prince. Your sister told us to return it to you when we got to the prison.
She did?
Ulrich looked surprised. He slipped the ring on his finger, and like his sword, it didn't quite fit and spun around from the weight of the gem.
I thought she took it. It has the royal seal. She could have used it to muster the nobles, to make laws, or to announce herself as Stuart. With it, she could have taken control of everything.
Maybe she was telling the truth, Hadrian suggested.
Let's not make snap judgments, Royce cautioned. First, let's see if this works. Your sister said you would need the ring to get into the prison. I thought she meant to identify you as the king, but I think she meant it a bit more literally. If I'm correct, touching the stone with the ring will cause giant doors to open.
They all gathered at the cliff face close to Ulrich in anticipation of the dramatic event.
Go ahead, Ulrich. Do it.
He turned the ring so the gem was on top, made a fist, and attempted to touch it to the cliff. As he did, his hand disappeared into the rock. Ulrich recoiled, wheeling backward with a cry.
What happened? Royce asked. Did it hurt?
No. It just felt sort of cold, but I can't touch it.
Try it again, Hadrian said.
Ulrich didn't look at all happy with the suggestion, but nodded just the same. This time he pressed farther, and the whole party watched as his hand disappeared into the wall up to his wrist before he withdrew it.
Fascinating, Royce muttered, feeling the solid stone of the cliff. I didn't expect that.
Does that mean he has to go in alone? Hadrian asked.
I'm not sure I want to enter solid stone by myself, Ulrich said with fear in his voice.
Well, you may have no choice, Royce responded, assuming you still want to talk to the wizard.
But let's not give up yet. Give me the ring a moment.
Despite his earlier desire for the ring, Ulrich now showed no concern at handing it over. Royce slipped it on, and when he pressed his hand to the cliff face, it passed into the mountainside just as easily as Ulrich's had. Royce pulled his hand back. Then he took the ring off, and holding it in his left hand, he reached out with his right. Once more, his hand passed through the stone.
So, you don't have to be a prince, and you don't have to be wearing it.
You only need to be touching it. Myron, didn't you say something about the gem creating a vibration?
Myron nodded. They create a specific resonance with certain stone types.
Try holding hands, Hadrian suggested.
Ulrich and Royce did so, and this time both could penetrate the stone.
That's it, Royce declared. One last test. Everyone join hands. Let's make sure it works with four.
They all joined hands, and each was able to pierce the surface of the cliff.
Everyone, make sure you've removed your hands before breaking the chain. Okay, we need to make some decisions before we go any further. I've seen some unusual things before, but nothing like this. I don't have a clue what will happen to us if we go in there. Well, Hadrian, what do you think?
Hadrian rubbed his chin.
It's a risk, to be sure. Considering some of the choices I've made recently, I leave this one up to you. If you think we should go, then that's good enough by me.
I have to admit, Royce responded, my curiosity is piqued. So if you still want to go through with this, Ulrich, we'll go with you.
If I had to go in alone, I would decline, Ulrich said. But I'm also curious.
Myron? Royce asked.
What about the horses? Will they be all right?
I'm sure they'll be fine.
But what if we don't come back? They'll starve, won't they?
Royce sighed. It's us or them. You'll have to choose.
Myron hesitated. Lightning and thunder tore through the sky, and it began to rain.
Can't we just untie them, so in case we don't...
I don't intend to make plans based on our expected deaths. We'll need the horses when we come out. They're staying. Are you?
The wind sprayed rain into the monk's face as he stole one last look at the horses.
I'll go, he said finally. I just hope they'll be all right.
Okay, Royce told them. This is how we'll do it. I'll go first, wearing the ring. Ulrich comes in behind me, then Myron, and Hadrian will take up the rear. When we get inside, we break the chain in reverse order. Hadrian first, then Myron, and Ulrich last. Enter in the same place I do, and don't pass me. I don't want anyone setting off any traps. Any questions?
All but Myron shook their heads.
Wait a second,
he said, as he trotted off toward where they had stored their gear. He gathered the lantern and tinder kit he had brought from the abbey and paused a moment to pet the horses' wet noses one more time.
I'm ready now,
he said, when he returned to the party.
All right, here goes. Everyone hang on and follow me,
Royce said, as they rejoined their chain and moved forward. One by one, they passed through the rock cliff. Hadrian was last. When the barrier reached his shoulder, he took a deep breath as if he were swimming, and with that, Hadrian dipped his head inside the stone.
Chapter 5 Ezra Harden. They entered into total darkness. The air was dry, still, and stale. The only sound came from rainwater dripping from their clothes. Hadrian took a few blind steps forward to make sure he was completely through the barrier before releasing Myron's hand.
"See anything, Royce?"
he asked in a whisper so quiet it could scarcely be heard.
"No, not a thing. Everyone stay still until Myron gets the lantern lit."
Hadrian could hear Myron fiddling in the dark. He tilted his head, searching in vain for anything to focus on. There was nothing. He could have had his eyes closed. Myron scraped the tiny metal lever on his tinder pad, and a burst of sparks flashed on the monk's lap. In the flare, Hadrian saw faces glaring from the darkness. They appeared briefly and vanished with the dying brilliance. No one moved or spoke as Myron scraped the pad again. This time the tinder caught fire, and the monk lit the wick of the lantern. The light revealed a narrow hallway
only 5 feet wide, and a ceiling that was so high it was lost in the darkness. Lining both walls were carvings of faces, as if people standing on the other side of the grey curtain were pressing forward to peer at them. Seemingly caught in a moment of anguish, frozen forever in stone, their terrible, ghastly visages stared at the party with gaping mouths and wild eyes. "Pass up the light," Royce ordered softly. As the lantern moved from Myron to Royce, its light shone on more faces. To Hadrian, it seemed as if they screamed at the intruders, but the corridor remained still and silent. Some of the figures had eyes wide with fear, while others' eyes were shut tight, perhaps to avoid seeing something too frightening to look at. "Someone certainly had a morbid taste in decorating," Royce said, taking the lantern.
"I'm just thankful they're only carvings. Imagine if we could hear them," Ulrich said.
"What makes you think they're carvings?" Hadrian asked, reaching out to gingerly touch the nose of a woman with glaring eyes. He half expected warm skin and was grateful when his fingers met cold stone. "Maybe they let go of their gemstones too soon." Royce held the lantern up high. "The passage keeps going."
"More faces?" Ulrich asked.
"More faces," the thief confirmed.
"At least we're out of the rain," Hadrian said, trying to sound cheerful. "We could still be back."
When he turned around, he was shocked. The corridor extended behind them, seemingly without end.
"Where's the wall we just came through?"
He took a step and reached out.
"It's not an illusion. The hallway keeps going."
Turning back, Hadrian saw Royce pressing on the sides of the corridor. Unlike with the wall outside, his hand did not penetrate the surface.
"Well, this is going to make matters difficult," the thief muttered.
"There must be another way out, right?"
Ulrich asked, his voice a bit shaky.
The thief looked back, then forward, and sighed. "We might as well travel in the direction we entered. Here, Ulrich, take your ring back, although I'm not sure what good it'll do you in here."
Royce led them down the corridor. He checked and tested anything that appeared suspicious. The passage went on for what seemed like eternity. Despite the hallways appearing perfectly straight and level, Hadrian began to wonder if the dwarves had built an imperceptible curve that made it loop back onto itself to form a circle. He also worried about the amount of oil left in Myron's lantern. It wouldn't be long before they were cast back into utter darkness. The lack of variation in their surroundings made it impossible to judge exactly how long they had been walking. After a while, something luminescent appeared in the distance. A tiny light bobbed and weaved. As the light drew closer, the echo of sharp, deliberate footsteps accompanied it. At last, Hadrian could discern the figure carrying a lamp. He was tall and trim, and wore a long hooded hauberk. Over this was a scarlet and gold tabard that shimmered in the lamplight. The tabard was marked with a regal coat of arms depicting a celestial crown and a jeweled scepter above a shield divided into quarters, and supported on either side by combatant lions. At his side he wore a polished sword with decorative detailing, and on his head a pointed silver helm, exquisitely etched with gold ivy trim. Below the helm were a pair of dark eyes and an even darker look.
"Why are you here?"
His tone was reproachful and threatening. There was a pause before Royce replied,
"We're here to see the prisoner."
"That is not allowed," he responded firmly.
"Then Ezra Harden is still alive?" asked Ulrich.
"Do not speak that name,"
thundered the sentry. He cast a tense look over his shoulder into the darkness.
"Not here,"
not ever here. You shouldn't have come.
That may be, but we are here, and we need to see Ezra...
the prisoner, Royce replied.
That will not be possible.
Make it possible, Ulrich ordered. His voice was loud and commanding. He stepped out from behind the others. I'm King Ulrich of Melengar, lord of this land wherein you stand. You will not tell me what is and what is not possible within the boundaries of my own kingdom.
The sentry took a step back and eyed Ulrich critically.
You lack a crown, king.
Ulrich drew his sword. Despite its size, he handed it smoothly and extended the point at the sentry.
What I lack in a crown, I more than make up for in a sword. A sword will not avail you. None who dwell here fear death any longer.
Hadrian couldn't tell whether it was the weight of the sentry's words or the weight of the sword, but Ulrich lowered his blade.
Do you have proof of your rank?
Ulrich extended a clenched hand.
This is the seal of Melengar, symbol of the House of Essendon, and emblem of this realm.
The sentry stared at the ring and nodded.
If you are the reigning sovereign of the realm, you do have the right to enter. But know this. There is magic at work here. You will do well to follow me closely.
He turned and led them back the way they had come.
Do you recognize the emblem on the guard?
Hadrian whispered to Myron as they followed him.
Yes, that's the coat of arms of the Novronian Empire, worn by the Persepolis Imperial City Guard. It's very old.
Their guide led them out of the corridor filled with faces, and Hadrian was grateful to be free of it. The hallway opened into a massive cavern with a vaulted ceiling carved from natural stone and supported by pillars of the same. Torches lining the walls revealed a magnificent expanse. It appeared large enough to hold all of Medford. They traversed it by crossing narrow bridges that spanned chasms and travelling through open arches that rose like great trees whose branches supported the mountain above. There was no visible sign of wood, fabric, or leather. Everything, chairs, benches, desks, tables, shelves, and doors, was made of stone. Huge fountains, hewn from rock, gurgled with water from unseen springs. The walls and floors lacked the adornment of tapestries and carpets. Instead, carved into virtually every inch of the stone were intricate markings, strange symbols of elaborate, twisted designs. Some of them were chiseled with a rough hand, while others were smoothly sculpted. At times, from the corner of his eye, Hadrian thought he saw the carved markings change as he passed them. Looking closely, he discovered it was not an illusion. The shifts were subtle, like the movement of cobwebs in the wake of their passing. They moved deeper, and their escort didn't pause or waver. He walked at a brisk pace, which at times caused Myron, who had the shortest legs, to trot in order to keep up. Their footfalls bounced off the hard walls throughout the stone chamber. The only other sounds Hadrian heard were voices, distant whispers of hidden conversations, but they were too faint for him to make out the words. Whether the sounds were from inhabitants around an unseen corner, or the result of some trick of the stone, was impossible to tell. Farther in, sentinels began to appear, standing guard along their path. Most were dressed identically to their guide, but others, found deeper in the prison, wore black armour with the simple white emblem of a broken crown. Sinister-looking helms hid their faces as they stood at perfect attention. None of them moved or said a word. Hadrian asked Myron about the emblem these men wore.
The crest is used by the ancient order of the Serret Knights, the monk explained quietly. They were first formed 800 years ago by Lord Darius Seret, who had been charged by Patriarch Lenev with the task of finding the lost heir of Navran. The broken crown is symbolic of the shattered empire which they seek to restore. Finally, they reached what Hadrian assumed was their final destination. They entered an oval chamber with an incredibly tall door dominating the far wall. Carved of stone, it stood wreathed in a glittering array of fine spiderweb-like designs, which appeared organic in nature. Like the veins of a leaf, or the delicate curling tendrils of sprawling roots, the doorframe spread out until its artistry was lost in the shadows. On either side of the door stood dramatic obelisks covered with runes cut deep in beveled stone. Between these and the door, blue flames burned in braziers mounted on high pedestals. A man sat on a raised chair behind a 6-foot-tall stone desk that was exquisitely sculpted with intricate patterns of swirling lines. On two sides of the work table, barrel-thick candles twice the height of a man burned. So many melted wax tears streaked down their sides that Hadrian thought they might once have been as tall as the great door. "Visitors," their guide announced to the clerk, who, until then, had been busy writing in a massive book with a black feathered quill. The man looked up from his work. His grey beard hung all the way down to the floor. Deeply lined with wrinkles, his face looked like the bark of an ancient tree.
"What are your names?" the clerk asked.
"I'm Ulrich Brendan Essendon, son of Amrath Essendon, King of Melengar, Lord of the Realm, and I demand an audience with the prisoner."
"The others?"
the clerk motioned toward the rest. "They are my servants, the royal protectors, and my chaplain." The clerk rose from his seat and leaned forward to examine each party member in more detail. He looked into the eyes of each for a moment before he resumed his seat. He dipped his feather quill and turned to a new page. After a few moments of writing, he asked,
"Why do you wish to see the prisoner?"
With his quill poised, he waited for a reply.
"My business is not your concern," Ulrich answered in a kingly voice.
"That may be. However, this prisoner is my concern, and if you have dealings with him, it is my business. I must know your purpose, or I will not grant you entry, king or not."
Ulrich stared at the clerk for some time before relenting.
"I wish to ask him questions concerning the death of my father."
The clerk considered this a moment, then scratched his quill on the page of the great book. When he finished, he looked up.
"Very well. You may enter the cell, but you must obey our rules. They are for your own safety. The man to whom you wish to speak is no ordinary man. He is a thing, an ancient evil, a demon that we have successfully trapped here. Above all else, we are dedicated to keeping him confined. As you might imagine, he very much desires to escape. He is cunning, and perpetually tests us. Constantly he is looking for a weakness, a break in a line or a crack in the stone. First, proceed directly down the path to his confinement. Do not tarry. Second, stay in the gallery. Do not attempt to descend to his cage. Third, and this is the most important, do nothing he asks. No matter how insignificant it may sound, do not be fooled by him. He is intelligent and cunning. Ask him your questions, then leave. Do not deviate from these rules. Do you understand?"
Ulrich nodded.
"Then may Navron have mercy on you."
Just then, the great doors split along the central seam and slowly started to open. The loud grinding of stone on stone echoed until at last the doors stood wide. Beyond them lay a long stone bridge that spanned an abyss.
The bridge was 3 feet wide and as smooth as glass, and it appeared no thicker than a sheet of parchment. At the far end of the span rose a column of black rock. An island-like tower, its only visible connection to the world, was the delicate bridge.